is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Hi, this is Jay Pierce, station manager of WILL Radio. In less than a week, the U.S. House of Representatives will vote on a bill that would cut federal funding for public broadcasting by 45%. This cut would be devastating to WILL. Many of you have called your congressmen and senators to let them know how much you support public broadcasting. If you haven't done so, we hope you will soon. For the phone numbers of your members of Congress, call us at 217-333-1070 or visit our website, will.uiuc.edu. It's very important that Washington hear from you on whether federal funding for WILL should be cut or restored. Thanks.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Historian Douglas Flaming is our guest this afternoon. The theme of his most recent book, Bound for Freedom, Black Los Angeles in Jim Crow America, is Civil Rights as a Way of Life. Flaming's book tells the story of black Americans heading west to Los Angeles in search of freedom and liberty in the first half of the 20th century. He says theirs was a struggle to protect and gain rights. He says they fought to protect the rights they had while simultaneously fighting to gain rights that were their due as Americans. Flaming says black Angelenos saw themselves as Westerners. He says, quoting here, Los Angeles styled itself a Western city, and its black leaders identified both the city and their community with the West. They spoke of themselves as Westerners and insisted that racial prejudice was incompatible with Western ideals. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Douglas Flaming is Associate Professor of History at the Georgia Institute of Technology. He is the author of Creating the Modern South, Mill Hands and Managers in Dalton, Georgia, 1884 to 1984. The book was awarded the Philip Taft Labor History Award. His new book, Bound for Freedom, Black Los Angeles and Jim Crow America, is published by the University of California Press. Douglas Flaming, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Sure, my pleasure. The prologue to the first part of the book is called Arrival, and it's here we find Charlotta Speer arriving in Los Angeles the year 1910. She had taken the train from Rhode Island to Los Angeles. Why had she left Rhode Island?
That's one of the great mysteries of Charlotta Speer's life, and I never was able to determine it. I know what she said, and for want of a better explanation, mm-hmm. we'll have to accept that until we find out a clue elsewhere. But she said she came for her health, as many Angelenos, as the people of Los Angeles call themselves Angelenos. Many Angelenos say they came for their health, and many did. Many still do. She said that a physician in Rhode Island encouraged her to go west to Los Angeles and soak up as much sunshine as she could. And that's all she says about it.
Hmm. And she didn't plan to stay forever, but she did.
No, she didn't. But by turns, she came into contact with the editor of a black-owned newspaper there, John Nemore, who was running at the time a struggling newspaper called the Eagle. And she took up with the paper And then just before he passed away, he asked her if she would try to keep it running. And she said she would do her best. And there began her new adventure in Los Angeles.
Yeah, she found herself owning the paper.
Owning the paper. Actually, it was put up for sale by the person who actually owned the building. And she really didn't have the money to bid for it. She didn't know what to do. he felt in despair. And then an African-American in the community who knew, who had known John Nemore and knew who Charlotta Spear was, saw her in despair and said, if you want to keep the newspaper running, I'll buy it for you and you can pay me back as you can. And they shook hands, the deal was done, and suddenly she was somebody.
Yeah. And then another news person, another newspaper owner enters the picture, enters her life, Joseph Blackburn Bass. Tell us about him.
Big Joe Bass, as he was often known. He was a person in the African-American West who had strong newspaper and political credentials. He was out of Kansas. Charlotta later would call him the big man from Kansas, and he was a large man. He was 6 foot, probably 6'1", and a barrel-chested man, large head and piercing eyes, and just a tremendous stature to him physically, but also he had been around in the Republican political circles of the West in Kansas and later Montana, and he was a longtime newspaper man, ran a race paper, and as they were called, black-owned newspapers were called race papers. He ran one in Kansas, he ran one in Helena, and then he took a break. He said it was just a break from his paper in Helena, Montana, and took off for a tour of the West, found Los Angeles, and never left, and went into Charlotta's California Eagle office. They met. And they became partners both in the newspaper business and in marriage in 1914.
Yeah. Now we have a woman from Rhode Island and a man from Kansas. Did their place of origin affect their worldview and how they saw Los Angeles?
That's an interesting question. And I've thought a lot about that, and I think it did. I think it definitely did. I think that Charlotta, for her part, expected perhaps a greater degree of individual liberty and equality than, say, someone from Atlanta or Jackson, Mississippi, or Houston, Texas might have had when they arrived. And Joe Bass, being a Westerner, and he called himself a Westerner, very emphatic on the point, that the West was the last great hope of egalitarianism in America. And, of course, he knew that it was not equal and that blacks were not did not enjoy full civil rights in the West. But he believed that you could use that Western ideal, that rhetoric of Western egalitarianism, of Western equality, to put pressure on white authorities to say, look, you're not living up to the Western ideal. By keeping blacks in a half-free condition, you must You're breaking the code of the West, as it were, breaking the ethic of the West. And so the West became this very important civil rights rhetoric in Los Angeles that you don't find elsewhere. But it's also true, and this is an important point in the book, that both of those, both Charlotta and Joe, really were tuned in, as most black Americans were, to the American South and how badly things were there, about lynchings, about Southern Democratic demagogues, about disfranchisement, about Jim Crow. And so they were always highlighting, just as you said in the introduction, highlighting the possibilities of the West versus the depredations of the South.
Yeah. Well, that's something that you state very plainly early in the book. Black Los Angeles always had in view both the South and the West. And this was true regardless of where you came from. And for Joe and Charlotta Bass, there was great concern that the West was in danger of becoming another South. What did they see? What was in their vision that they saw as being a sign that, that if we don't continue to struggle, if we don't fight, this could become another South?
That's a good question, and I think the best answer is what they had in view was a migration of white Southerners who were also coming to Los Angeles. Los Angeles was a very Midwestern city. The West Coast of Iowa, I guess, is what they used to call it. So it wasn't as if Southern whites were bringing their bigotry to Los Angeles in huge, overwhelming numbers and taking over the city. But many whites who did come to the far west, to Los Angeles, from Dixie, brought their Jim Crow attitudes with them. And whereas blacks in Los Angeles said, we're not free enough, white Southerners in Los Angeles said very vocally, and oftentimes violently and aggressively, there's too much freedom for blacks in Los Angeles. So I think the primary answer is that white Southerners who were moving west for their own vision of a new world suddenly found that that blacks in the West weren't, if you will, in their place as they had been back in the South. So I think part of what they had in view was quite literally white Southerners and the Jim Crow and calls for Jim Crow.
Hmm. Let's talk about an earlier arrival now, Robert Owens and family. Coming from Texas in the 1850s, they had been slaves.
Indeed. That's an interesting journey. And in some ways, I'd like to see somebody write an entire book on Owens, the Owens family itself. That would be a worthy study. That is during the antebellum period, so slavery is still very much in force. Owens is able to buy himself out of slavery and then work on his own as an independent person in Texas until he's able to buy his entire family out of slavery. And one can only imagine how difficult that must have been. Once that happened, loaded up an ox cart and took it west to what was then the very dusty town of Los Angeles, which had long been Afro-Spanish, and then a Mexican national pueblo, and then finally an American town. He shows up in the 1850s, virtually the only black person in the town, and it's not particularly the most egalitarian place on earth
right.
when he shows up. But he makes his way. He sticks it out. He gets some government contracts for to supply the U.S. Army out there in the 1850s with cattle and wood, and begins a business. And his family grows. Some more move in, and there you have the beginnings of a community that. Really is a small but influential foundation for the black community that I study.
Yeah. Well, at that point when Robert Owens and his family, his wife and three children, are coming to Los Angeles in 1853, California is a free state, but the city of Los Angeles, its majority was pro-slavery.
Absolutely, and that's one of the That's one of the interesting things about Owens. It's one of the interesting things about the famous Biddy Mason court case that took place after Owens arrived. I discussed that a little bit in my book. That's a very complicated and fascinating story. Biddy Mason being and her children and grandchildren and some others being the slaves of a Mormon couple southern out of Mississippi who had gone with the Mormons to the Utah Territory and then started a Mormon colony in San Bernardino, which is just east of Los Angeles. Long story short is that before the Mormon family decides to take the white Mormon family decides to take them back to Texas. There's some of the whites in town join with the Owens, Robert Owens and family, to insist that because they're in a free state, they're free to stay. This is before the Dred Scott decision, and a Southern judge, a former slaveholding judge, agrees that in fact they are free. In a very interesting and paradoxical decision. There's a good book on that, by the way, a tremendous book that I would recommend to all readers who are interested in race and family and freedom and movement to the West, and that's by the author Dieta Demaritus, The Force of a Feather. It's a story about Biddy Mason and Hannah and the other slaves that were in that party.
As you researched this book, what were some of the resources that you came across that you thought were spectacular? You mentioned The Force of a Feather. I would imagine that that book played a role in leading you to Bound for Freedom in the writing of this book. Were there other things that stood out for you?
The things that stood out most for me in writing this book were the sources that gave voice to the people of Los Angeles, gave voice to the people themselves, to their aspirations, to their hopes, to their frustrations, to their desire for freedom, their tenacity to fight it out. And those were sources such as the race papers, the black-owned newspapers, which are a tremendously rich source for African-American history, and there were several race papers in Los Angeles, and Charlotta and Joe Bass's paper, The California Eagle, being the one of which we have the fullest run, and was probably the most important over time, at least until the 1930s. There were other papers as well. In the 1960s and 1970s, to look ahead, there was a wave of oral histories done by several universities in the Los Angeles area of black leaders during the time period, blacks who were leaders during the time period I studied. UCLA did quite a few interviews. Cal State Fullerton did quite a few interviews. And those people had already passed, generally speaking, had passed away before I started my study. But fortunately, I had oral history interviews that had been done previously. There were a few manuscript collections. There were quite a few autobiographies that came out of the community that I could draw on as well.
Hmm. So, including Charlotta Bass, although it wasn't really extremely helpful for you.
Well, it's an interesting book. You're onto something there. It was it's one of those books that can give you hints about what's going on, and that can be very helpful. But you're not going to get a very detailed description of any event. And she played it pretty close to the vest, particularly on her personal life. Now, about her life as a public leader, as a civic activist, she is more than willing to discuss her life. But as for her private life, she keeps it to herself. So we really don't know that much about the private life of Charlotta Bass.
Yeah. What would you like to say about the course of her life, the arc of her life?
I think that there was something about coming to Los Angeles to get well and then becoming in the most surprising way, the owner of the leading black newspaper in town, of a growing African-American community, that kind of gave her a sense of destiny, if you will, a sense that she was to be and her life was to be more than just whatever she had planned to be before in Rhode Island. She embraced the West as a kind of starting over. And at first, to take the rising arc of her life, she rises with her new husband and partner, Joe Bass. They run the newspaper together through the 1920s, and by that time, by the end of the decade, they're very influential black leaders in the West, and to some degree, they're well known throughout Los Angeles political circles. And then Joe Bass gets ill and passes away, and Charlotta just, her arc keeps rising at that point. And eventually, like most black Americans in the late 1930s, she'll shift from the party of Lincoln, the Republican Party, to the party of Roosevelt and the New Deal. And then she keeps on rising. The more she becomes, the more active she becomes, the more political risks she begins to take, the more outspoken she is, the more attention she receives, the more audience she receives, and finally she becomes, by the end of the book, one of the nation's leading radicals, the vice presidential candidate for the Progressive Party in 1952. That was a party that had no chance whatsoever to win, but it gave her a platform. She crisscrossed the nation several times in 1952, on a very, calling for a very progressive platform, almost utopian platform by 1952 standards. But the interesting thing is that everything she basically called for in 1952 has come, in fact, to pass. So that was kind of, I don't know whether the 52 campaign was the height of the arc of her career, or whether that was the denouement, but she settled back into Los Angeles, heavily trailed by the FBI by this time, who kept watch on her even after she had a stroke and went to the nursing home to live, and called her, even in the nursing home, potentially dangerous. Mm. So she would have been quite pleased with that description, I think, by this time.
Well, she so clearly is a character that, in this story, that stands for the theme of your book, Civil Rights as a Way of Life. In 1960, she's writing her autobiography. She's taking to task city leaders, including journalists.
Mm-hmm.
I can almost hear her, thanks to you, for writing African Americans out of the city's story, its history.
She was very vocal on that point. And she was particularly enraged that although the first Spaniards to arrive there and to create the Pueblo were primarily of African descent, I call them Afro-Spaniards, their race, their color, if you will, was whitewashed right out of the story. Over time, by white leaders who wanted a, shall we say, whiter Spanish beginnings. So she was very outraged that blacks were whitewashed out of the city's founding in the late 18th century. And I hope she'll forgive me for not paying too much attention to the founding, but paying more attention instead to her.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, historian Douglas Flaming. He is the author of Bound for Freedom, Black Los Angeles in Jim Crow America. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions, comments, 333-9455. The number to call if you're in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222. 800-222-WILL, 800-222-WILL. One of the things Black Angelenos liked about the city of Los Angeles, the L.A. Times.
This is an interesting point and was very unexpected to me to discover this. And this kept popping up in the race papers, in the in memoirs, autobiographies, in oral histories, and I think it was truer. It was very true in the first decade or so of the 20th century, when the community was just beginning to coalesce, find its feet, grow rapidly. And by the community there, I mean the Black community. And there were, Otis was just a fire-eating anti-labor reactionary. And that's how I've always known him. This is General Otis, who owned and ran the Los Angeles Times. And so he has in his... any historian will tell you that this is a very reactionary conservative paper, which in terms of organized labor, it certainly was. But organized labor was at that time, the early AFL, was itself quite racist and exclusionist. And so African Americans in town didn't have any thing to gain at that point by siding with organized labor, particularly the exclusionist AFL. So, in some sense, there was a connection there. Plus, Otis was a fiercely loyal Lincoln Republican. That is to say, he wasn't just a business Republican. He still believed in the old kind of Lincoln emancipation, Reconstruction idea of the Republican Party, and to an extent that is very surprising to me, and I suspect will be surprising and somewhat controversial to readers. The L.A. Times reached out to the African-American community, and I think just beyond political expediency, I think. To some extent, Otis let some of his writers, particularly the editor John Stephen McGordy, write some very powerful statements in favor of equal opportunity and equal rights, which is not to say that the LA Times was always true to the cause. You can find any number of racist, terribly racist cartoons, the occasional bitter diatribe in the letters to the editor, and the occasional story that bashes the Black community for whatever reason. So it's not altogether, they're not universally true to the Black community. But in a way that truly surprised me, the LA Times of those decades was reaching out, was seeking to understand the Black community, was speaking in favor of it in various civil rights disputes in town, and Black leaders responded very favorably to this kind of treatment, which is partly a testament to the Times, LA Times, and partly a testament to how badly African Americans were treated in the press, the white press, elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, the importance of the press is very interesting in this story as well. And there's another paper, of course, very famous paper, The Crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And you write about Jim Crow West Coast style, and a woman by the name of Louise McDonald, living in Los Angeles in 1912, wrote about the things that she saw with the city that were wrong. We suffer almost anything except lynching right here in the beautiful land of sunshine. Civil privileges are here unknown. You can't bathe at the beaches, eat in any first-class place, nor will the streetcar and sightseeing companies sell us tickets if they can possibly help it. I am speaking from experience. So what was it that drew African Americans to Los Angeles early in the 20th century?
That's a great letter by Louise McDonald. And that's a critical point in the Bound for Freedom story, because she's sending in this letter to the crisis saying the conditions are really bad here. You know, don't think of this as the golden land. And at the same time, there's evidence of I quote another person in the book, a white Southerner, A.J. Davis, who's writing a letter that he distributes publicly that's a diatribe against how free blacks are in Los Angeles, and that it's an outrage that it's not more like the American South. And so there's always this paradox going on, it seems to me, in Los Angeles. And I think for every Louise McDonald who's emphasizing the fact that, gosh, they're not nearly as free as people think we are, there are also those who are just arriving from the South, for example, and say, wow, there's a lot more freedom here. You know, we were right to move here. And why? Because we can own homes, nice homes, without going broke, and we can move into nicer neighborhoods. And sometimes, if it's an all-white neighborhood, there'll be a protest. There'll be death threats, the usual. But usually, those will subside, and blacks will be able to stay put. There are plenty of jobs. Not great jobs for black Americans. There was no law at all about equal hiring, so it was perfectly legal for any white employer or any employer at all to discriminate on account of religion, race, color, nationality, gender, what have you. So blacks didn't get the good jobs, but they did get plenty of jobs, and jobs that paid much better than elsewhere in the country. Home ownership rates in the West and in Los Angeles in particular for African Americans were quite high compared to the national scene. So there were reasons to move. And no one really pulled up stakes without kind of checking into it first, or without having a very severe incident in the South and just having to rush west. Most people wrote letters back and forth. You know, they checked into the situation. Are the schools good? Yes, the schools are good, and there aren't a lot of racial problems in them. Okay. Are there places to live? Yes, there are good homes at good prices. Are there jobs? Yes, they're decent jobs that pay decent wages. And, of course, blacks could always vote, which they could no longer do in the South. So.
Hmm. The neighborhoods, the schools, were they integrated or segregated?
Schools were integrated. Mm-hmm. There would be the occasional movement toward segregated schools, but that generally came later in the 20s and the 30s. In the early years of the century, the schools were integrated, and there wasn't a great push to segregate them. When there will come a significant push to segregate them, it will be aimed mostly at the Mexican immigrants or Mexican Americans or the Japanese. And blacks didn't quite know how to negotiate that complicated terrain, because they knew on the one hand that discrimination against Mexican immigrants and Japanese immigrants was taking some of the racist heat off of them, you see.
Mm-hmm.
But they knew also that racism is racism and eventually would rebound onto them as well. So it was hard to say, but the schools were integrated.
Yeah, it was interesting to realize that there's so much back and forth in terms of a step forward or two steps forward and one step back. At one point, the public swimming pools were segregated, but then a decade later, they're opened up again.
It's almost impossibly hard to find any straightforward pattern. And I write early on in the book that things got better and worse at the same time,
mm-hmm.
Which is, in the end, the only way to see it. If you sort of line up the victories that black Angelenos won on the civil rights ledgers, and then you line up the defeats that they suffered, they sort of run parallel. And oftentimes it's impossible to gauge where racism would come from, when it would pop up. The swimming pools were open, were integrated until, 1924, and then boom, suddenly they're not. And that seemed to come out of nowhere. I was never able to find out what was the impetus toward that. And then a decade later, through the activism, really, of one particular woman backed by the NAACP, Betty Hill, the swimming pools in Los Angeles were integrated again. So it's a very curious city in terms of racial conditions, and it still is. And I think that, to a large degree, America and American race relations are now everywhere as unpredictable as they were then.
Hmm. Also, it's interesting to see the development of Central Avenue as both a success and maybe less than a success. I mean, it was sort of, do you know what I'm saying?
Yes,
maybe talk about the development of Central Avenue.
Well, Central Avenue is a, there was a, when I used to live in Los Angeles, I lived there nearly 10 years, through the late 80s, most of the 90s. There was kind of a backlash against the notion that all blacks in Los Angeles lived in South Central LA, because it was by then a huge area with lots of subdivisions, and it was just kind of a blanket term that was used, usually disparagingly, to identify all blacks and other underrepresented minorities in the city. But in the beginning, Central Avenue, or South Central Avenue, because it ran south of Main Street, was a point of pride for Afro-Angelenos, because it was a place that they began to build up impressive institutions, in particularly the black churches, various black businesses, and black boosters would boost it. You know, this is a great section for Los Angeles. Blacks, in fact, were a minority in the Central Avenue district, a minority of the population, but they claimed it as their own and built their churches, had most of their homes and there, most of their businesses were there, and then over time, they moved southward. They moved southward on South Central because they couldn't move west because of restrictive real estate covenants, racially restrictive real estate covenants. But South Central was not a slum, was not a ghetto by any stretch of the imagination, or a slum. And so moving south wasn't such a bad thing because the neighborhoods were pretty good southward, and at that point in time. But you're right, it was a it was a it was a place in the city that blacks were at turns proud of and then frustrated with. I think that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
It's because Joe Bass, for example, would be praising the black business owners on South Central and race progress and so on in one issue of the California Eagle. And then in the next, he'll be blasting the community for not supporting black business, for patronizing white stores and Japanese stores rather than black-owned stores. And that is not, so at turns it was the glory of black Los Angeles, and at turns it was leaders were depressed because it was not growing and developing and prospering as much as they had hoped.
Hmm. We've only just touched on the role of the church, the churches, and Charlotta Bass said the press and the pulpit are the two main centers for the development of community consciousness. To wrap up here, maybe this afternoon, would you talk a little bit about the role of churches in community consciousness in Los Angeles?
I agree with Charlotta Bass on that. And the churches were vitally important, not only as places of worship, but as places for community consciousness, community building, getting employment, getting a loan, a place where you, because they were separated, not segregated, but separate by choice, blacks built the churches. They built, when they could, they built very nice churches. And the churches, for example, served as centers for civic activism. The NAACP meetings, the monthly meetings, were always held at a church and at a different church each month. They rotated through, you see. So when you're leading civic groups, NAACP, Urban League, women's clubs, are all operating in the churches, and people are, identifying themselves with the churches and their community with the churches and settling in the neighborhoods around the churches they build, then the churches are a center both of community and civic activism.
Hmm.
And I think that to a large extent that's still true. Certainly was through the mainstream civil rights movement of the 1960s. And I think it's a very important paradox that the churches are separate, but they're using that separate identity, that separateness, to gain strength as a group in order to achieve civil rights and equal rights as individuals. You see? So it's separation for integration.
Mm-hmm.
Not integration meaning becoming white, but integration meaning having equal opportunities in the other spheres of life.
Mm. And again, that reminds me of the story of Central Avenue.
Yes.
It same kind of thing going on there.
Exactly.
Yeah. To sum up, anything you'd like to say here?
Well, not necessarily, other than to say that I thank you for having me on. I suppose Bound for Freedom in the End is a book about hope, a book about never giving up on freedom, about seeing a world of equal opportunity, and no matter how many times you lose, and no matter how many times you're beaten down, there's still hope. And I think that what I learned from the community, after studying it for so many years, is that it gets back to the main theme that you brought up originally, is civil rights as a way of life, and believing that the city is a project, ongoing project, worth pursuing and putting your life into. I'm a pessimist myself, but these the people in the book are not. They always believe, no matter what. They just keep getting up and fighting back. And so it's a very inspiring story for me to stumble upon and to discover.
There we'll leave it. Professor Flaming, thank you very much for joining me this afternoon.
The pleasure's mine.
Historian Douglas Flaming has been our guest this afternoon. He is the author of Bound for Freedom, Black Los Angeles and Jim Crow America. The book is published by the University of California Press. Our guest, Douglas Flaming, Associate Professor of History at the Georgia Institute of Technology. You've been listening to an interview from the AM 580 archives. You'll find interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and Focus 580 on our website. Visit WILL.UIUC.EDU.
Now here with the settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade as well as the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. This is Dave Dickey. An interesting day at the Chicago Board of Trade, where we did indeed see many new highs made across the complexes, but soybeans and corn came back off their session highs for the day. We'll have to talk about the implications of that. At 2:06 on the closing market report, our guest will be Kurt Kimmel of Grainfield Marketing in Normal, Illinois. We'll get you caught up on all that's going on in the markets, as well as take a look at agricultural news and agricultural weather, which is indeed the driving force behind this near-term uptrend in the markets. Let's go ahead and look at the settlements. Beginning in the wheat pit, as we always do, the July wheat contract, a high on the day of 339.5, a low of 332.5, settling 339 up 11.5. September, a high of 350, a low of 342.5, settling 348.5 up 11. December, a high of 360.5, a low of 354, settling 359.75 up 11. March, a high of 371, a low of 365, settling 370 up 11. And the May contract, this begins to sound like a broken record, also up 11 on the day. The high, 371, the low, 367, settling on the high, 371 on the day. July corn, a high of 236.25, a low of 231.75, settling 235.5, up 6.5. September, a high of 241.5. Make it 246 for the high, the low 241.5, settling 245.25, up 6.25. December, a high of 256.75, a low of 252.25, settling 255.75, up 6.75. March, a high of 263, a low of 259, settling 262.25, up 6.25. May, a high of 265, a low of 261.5, settling 264.5, up 5.75. July, the red line, a high of 267, a low of 263.5, settling 266.75, up 4.75 on the day. July oats, a high of 157.5, a low of 154, settling 155.5, up 3.25. September, a high of 161.5, a low of 159.75, settling on the low, 159.75, up 3. July soybeans, a high of 748, a low of 732, settling 739, up 15. August, a high of 754, a low of 736.5, settling 744.5, up 17. September, a high of 755, a low of 740, settling 750, up 18.5. November beans, a high of 764, a low of 748, settling 757.5, up 16. January, a high of 765, a low of 751, settling 757.5, up 15. March, a high of 751, a low of 738, settling 744, up 15.5. July soybean meal, a high of 238, a low of 230.80, settling 232.40, up 340. August, a high of 237, a low of 231.50, settling 233.50, up 480. July soybean oil, a high of 25.90, a low of 25.50, settling 25.58, up 50. August, a high of 25.92, a low of 25.57, settling 25.68, up 47 on the day. Settlement prices also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, where feeder and live cattle higher on the day. The nearbys and the lean hogs also higher, while the deferreds lost ground today. August feeders, a high on the day of 108.75, a low of 107.65, settling 108.65, up 107.5. September, a high of 107.70, a low of 106.45, settling 107.60, up 125. October feeders, a high of 106.70, a low of 105.40, settling 106.62.5, up 147.5. June live cattle, a high of 82.15, a low of 81, settling 82.05, up 85. August, a high of 80.55, a low of 79.60, settling 80.25, up 35. July lean hogs, a high of 66.65, a low of 65.90, settling 66.25, up 30. August, a high of 66, a low of 64.65, settling 65.80, up 85. October, a high of 56.40, a low of 55.25, settling 55.85, down 2.5. December lean hogs, a high of 54.20, a low of 53.60, settling 53.90, down 2.5. July pork bellies, a high of 65.10, a low of 64.00, settling 64.12.5, down 32.5. Outside markets for you on the day. Beginning in the crude oil pit, the July crude oil at 59.50 now, up 103 on the day. Spin is high today as 59.52. The CRB at 313.75, up over 2 points again today after being up over 2 on Friday. It's up 2.77 at the moment. The U.S. dollar 88.51, up 0.85. The Dow Jones Industrial Average down almost 12.5 points at 10,610. At settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade and the Merck.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, a Subaru Stellar Performer certified dealership, now in their new location in front of the Savoy 16 Theater across from Warden Martin Nissan. Information on the web at wardenmartin.subaru.com.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Catherine Grayson from Melbourne, Australia wants to know, Dear Dr. Science, can you test the UV protection efficiency of sunscreen using photography paper?
You could, but it would be a roundabout way to test your sunscreen. Why not just rub it on your back? If you need to have the experiment seem more convoluted or scientific, you could rub it on the backs of laboratory rats or students on work study and then expose them to the midday sun. Remember to take copious notes and offer your subjects plenty of liquids.